My, my.
My name's Chip Collins, and I am an alcoholic. I ain't had a drink all day long. I didn't hurt nobody, and I didn't hurt myself. I worked all week long, paid my way. When I left my home, my wife and children were sad to see me go. And I called in, and they told me to hurry home. And that might not sound much to y'all, but my first marriage, I got drunk, and I went to the store, and I ended up in Zihuatanejo, Mexico. And I called her after 3 weeks, and she answered the phone, and it was ice cold. And she said, "What do you want?" And I said, "I'm in Mexico." She goes, "So?" She goes, I said, "Send me some money, or I'll come home." My sobriety date's May 12th, 1984. And my home group is Robber's Roost, meets on Thursday night in Vista, California. I want to thank the committee for asking me to be a part of this, and I've had such a great time. You guys really, really treated me well. You know, I've gained about 10 pounds, and I've slept like I've never slept. You know, I love total anonymity, completely out of state where nobody knows you, and you know, and you don't have a cell phone, and you don't have a pager, and you know, and nobody knows. It's just dynamite. And, you know, I've just been humbled by the speakers before me. You know, Michelle told my story. I can sit down, you know. I mean, she told my story in 10 minutes. I got to tell you, though, that Mazzella, I do have a resentment at you. We had plans to go fishing right after you last night, and you did scare all the fish off, you know. You know, I think my reputation has preceded me. For the last three conferences I've participated in, my host has been a lawyer. And I don't know if you know a lot about me, or we're just starting to really let a lot of riffraff in AA. You know. Sorry, Bob. My father's Irish and Sioux. And my mother's Irish and Cherokee. And when my father drank, my mama liked to fight. The way it was in my house, you know, me and my brother, we'd be laying there in that bed, and later it got. We'd be waiting to hear that pickup coming up the road, you know, and we'd be getting scareder and scareder. Pretty soon you'd hear that pickup coming up the driveway. And if you looked out the windows, you could see all the neighbors turning off their lights and coming outside with their lawn chairs. You know? I do not blame. I don't know if my father's an alcoholic. You know, I have no idea. That's something that we all have to answer to ourselves. But I did see what alcohol, I cannot blame my alcoholism on my father, you know, because he showed me exactly what happens to a man who drinks the way he drank, what happens to a family, what happens to a marriage, what happens to a career. He showed me exactly what would happen. So I cannot put it on him. I blame my alcoholism on the San Diego Unified School District. I was never, ever going to be an alcoholic, you know. My father was an alcoholic, and I never, ever wanted to be like him. But when I was about 12, they got this fantastic idea in San Diego County. This was in the mid-60s. That it was time to start educating these young people about the dangers of drugs. And right here now, I'd like to tell you that I do respect and support the singleness of purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous with all my heart. Part of my story includes that stuff that we don't talk about in AA meetings. So if that bothers you, this will be a perfect opportunity for you to grow tonight. See, they brought us all in this hall, and they set us down, and they showed us this movie, and they had these people come up and talk, and they showed what was going to happen, and I was sitting there looking at this, and my mouth was watering, you know. And I said, my God, I said, Balto, my partner, I said, can you get any of this? And he says, yeah, man, he says, my dad smokes that. And I said, well, get some, I'll meet you after school tomorrow. Met him after school. I said, you got it? He says, yeah, come on. I said, what do we do? He says, well, we got to go to a store. We got to go boost some wine. And I said, for what? He says, I don't know. My dad drinks cheap wine with this. I was willing to go to any lengths. So, you know, we went in this little store, and I boosted my very first short dog, a sweet red port, and it certainly wasn't my last, you know, but that was my first. And we went down this canyon, and we smoked this dope, and we drank this wine. And, oh, Lord. You know, my first speaker I ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous was a fellow from Venice Beach called Serenity Sam. And I come walking this room, he came up there, and I said, what the hell do these people know about people like me? And he got up there, and this is what he told me. He said a lot, but this is what I heard. He said, when I was born, he said, I fell out of my mother's womb and I hit a cold concrete floor and I was crawling across hostile territory towards my grave. And then I discovered alcohol. And I knew that he knew, you know. You know, I lived in a barrio. I grew up in it. I was the only Anglo in there. Me and my brother, we had white hair, blue eyes, and very white skin. All my cousins are Native American. They have very dark hair, they have dark skin, they have brown eyes, you know. And I didn't fit in this neighborhood, I didn't fit in this family, and everywhere we were different, you know. And we went outside of that house, me and my brother, those Mexicans wanted to beat on my ass. And I went inside that house, and that Indian wanted to beat on my ass, you know. And what happened was, you know, I learned at a very early age how to put on armor, you know. And I learned very early that if I could make you afraid of me, you wouldn't bother me. And that's the way me and my brother, you didn't touch one of us, you know. And it didn't matter if we had to wait for a year, we'd get you, you know. And that's just the way it was, you know. When I was 14 years old, my mother, I'd gotten kicked out of school for hitting a teacher. For the second time. He was a jerk. And I came home and my mom had found my stash, you know, and she said, get the hell out of my house. I don't think she really meant it, but, you know, when she said it, I went, okay, and I was gone, you know. And I went over to another little place and I talked to my friend and I'm going, man, I don't know what to do. Got no place to live, nothing to do, and he's reading a newspaper, and he says, you know, check this out. He said, all these people are going up to San Francisco, and all they do is get high and listen to music and make love. I like music, you know? At the age of 14 years old, I went up to the Haight-Ashbury district in 1964, and things were rocking, you know? And I'm positive that I had a good time, you know. I know I had to have, man. I caught too many diseases not to have. I got up and my dad had always told me, my father, besides an alcoholic, he was an incredible hard worker. I mean, he worked incredible hours and he always told me that, you know, if you want things out of life, you've got to work real hard. You got to obey all the rules. You got to do this. You got to do that. And, you know, I found out something living on those streets. When other young men were learning trades and going to school and doing what normal people do, you know, I learned something else. I learned something very valuable that affected me the rest of my life. I learned about people's vices. And I learned that if I could supply what you wanted, that I could have anything that I wanted or anybody I wanted. And it ain't nothing I'm proud of, but it was a way I learned to survive out there. And I'll just share in a very, very general way. You know, I'll tell you this, that I did absolutely everything I ever wanted to, and I did absolutely everything I ever had to, and I never looked back on any of it. I speak a little Spanish, you know, and I started seeing this deal with all everyone was making. Everybody wanted marijuana, and I know where it comes from. And I started smuggling dope across that border before I was old enough to cross it. And I got arrested in Mexico when I was 16 years old with 200 kilos of marijuana. And I was sentenced to 25 years in La Mesa Federal Penitentiary in Mexico. And thank God that Mexico is a civilized country. Because you can bribe people there. And, but I'll tell you this. When I walked in that jail, and I had long, blonde hair, and I had blue eyes and very fair skin, I'll tell you that nice things don't happen. And if anything in this world, that should have convinced me that I need to change the way I'm living. But you know, me and my brother, I called him, I got in touch with my brother, and I said, get me out of here, and we had lots of money. He found the right people, and after about 9 months, I got out of there. And I got back up here in the United States, and I continued to do what I do. On my 18th birthday, I was arrested, and I went to prison. I was charged with 27 felonies. And I made a whole bunch of new contacts. That's all jail ever was for me. I mean, it was just a resource center, you know? While I was in jail, I'd been living with this young gal, this young Spanish gal. She was just beautiful, and she came from a real good family. And we were going to have a baby, and we were incredibly excited about that child. And then I got arrested, and they locked me up. And after I finished that term, I got out of there, and I never heard from her the whole time I was there. And after I got out, I went looking for her, and nobody could find her. Nobody knew where she was. And I searched and searched, and then there was this hole in my gut because I wanted to hold this baby. You see, when I was a child, I hear what other people wanted to be when they grew up. You know, the only thing, I never said it out loud, but the thing I wanted to be more than anything in this world, I wanted to be a father. I wanted to have children. I wanted a family, because I'd never had one. You know, I wanted to do all those things that I never got to do. And I sought everywhere for this child, and nobody would tell me nothing, you know. And I walked around for a long time with a hole inside of me. I met this little gal. She was 15 years old. Sweet little thing. Came from a rich family. And she bailed me out of jail 3 times in 1 week. And I don't know anything about love, but I know a lot about jail. And I decided that I wanted her on my side, so I married her. And I took a hostage. And I took that little girl on a ride, and her ears are still ringing, you know. And we had a good time. She was a good woman, someone I could really count on. You know, I don't know anything about love. All I know about is business, and I know about how to make things happen. And I don't know, I don't let people get inside and touch me. But one day we went to this hospital. She said, we're going to have a baby. And I went into this hospital, and I waited. And they came out, and they put this little boy in my arms. And for the very first time in my life, the absolute very first time in my life, I experienced love. And I held this baby, and I looked at this baby, and something happened inside of me that just tore that armor off, and I fell head over heels in love with that child. And I started promising what kind of a father I'm going to be. I started making plans of the things me and him were going to do. And I promised him I'd always protect him. And I meant it with every part of me. And 2 years later, we went to another hospital, and you know, and they came out, and they put this little girl in my arms. And it was exactly the same thing. They put this baby in my arms, and that armor just fell off, and I fell head over heels in love. I'm the kind of alcoholic, I think real fast, you know, and I can go to a meeting and I'll see a real pretty gal. Before that meeting's over, we've been married, we've had a couple of kids, she cheated on me, and I hate her, you know. And I'm not the only one, huh? That's reassuring. You know, I'm looking at this little girl and I'm thinking about, you know, someday some guy's going to come and want to marry her. She's still wet, you know. And I've got all these conditions and I'm thinking about, you know, this wedding I'm going to have to give her and I'm planning it out. And that's just the way I think, long range, you know. And I planned on being, I promised her what kind of father I'd be. I promised her I'd protect her and I'd never let anybody hurt her. And I meant it with all every part of me, you know. And for the next 5 years, I had a lot of money and I only worked once in a while. And I stayed with my children and I changed my children's diapers and I cooked for them and I taught them how to walk and I taught them how to talk. You know, my son was born deaf and I learned sign language and I played with my kids, and that's what my life was about. And my life was good, I thought, you know, and drugs and alcohol were not a problem. It was just a means to an end for me. And on September 6, 1976, my guy came in and he brought some really good stuff over and I got really loaded and it was a very hot day. And me and my son were playing. We were home alone that day. And I got real thirsty and I just got on my bike. I didn't even think about it. I just got on my bike and I just took up to the store to go get a six-pack and I came back. And when I came back, the police were at my house and the paramedics were there and all the neighbors were out in the yard. And I walked out and in the middle of the thing, and my son had chased me out into the driveway and he'd been run over by a truck. And I waded through that crowd and I saw my son, the sunshine of my life, laying there with his head split open and I could see his brains and bones protruding from all the parts of his body. And something inside of me died. I spent the next 9 months in an intensive care hospital with my son, with him in a coma. And I just sat with him and I kept apologizing. And I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And my son survived. He had massive brain damage and incredible physical difficulties the rest of his life. He never mentally evolved beyond the age of about 4 years old. And he had a lot of problems. You know, right after that happened, my brother, who would anything that I've told you, my brother had been right there. We were only 11 months apart, and we backed each other's play, right or wrong, no matter what, under any circumstances. He was the only person in this world I trusted. My brother came down with a disease called schizophrenia, and my family had him committed to a hospital. My brother, they got him stabilized on this medication and therapy somewhat, and he called me from that hospital one night, and he said, "Kip, get me out of here." And I didn't say nothing. I just said, okay. And I went and talked to my mom. And I told her I'd take responsibility for him. And I went and got a lawyer. And I became his conservator. And I got him out of there with all these promises that I'd make sure he saw his doctor and take his medication and do all these things. And I bought him a mobile home and set it on a piece of property right next to mine. And me and my brother continued to do what we do. My brother started getting sick, you know. I had to make a delivery in the Midwest, and I told my brother, I said, "Look, man, I'll be back in three days, hold down the fort." And he said, "Man, you can't go nowhere." And I said, "Why, what's up?" And he says, "I don't know, but I'm coming apart. Something's desperately wrong." I go, "What do you mean?" He goes, "I don't know. Something's wrong inside of me. Please don't leave." I said, "Bill, you know I gotta go, man." And I gave him a handful of money. Money has fixed everything all my life. I said, "You know what, just hang on, man. It's always been me and you. It always will be. As soon as I get back, we'll fix whatever it is." And he said, "Please, don't go." And I had to pull his hand off. I told him I loved him. And I went back in the Midwest, and this thing I was on, it went sideways. And instead of 3 days, I was gone for 2 weeks. And when I came back, I would look for my brother, and nobody had seen him. And I walked up to that trailer, and I opened the door, and my brother's head rolled out at my feet. And the third day after I had left, he had taken that money and bought a gun and blown his head off. And when I opened that door, his body was laying there, and it was just a giant pile of maggots, and it just, something inside of me broke completely in half. I don't tell you this story because I want your sympathy, nor do I need it. The only point of me telling you any part of this states in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that there are those among us who got here with grave emotional and mental disorders, and I am one of those people. Something inside of me broke that day that was never, ever to be repaired until I completely surrendered to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you this from my heart to yours, that I thank God that alcohol does for me what it does. Because you see, alcohol works for me. It does things for me that I cannot do for myself. It takes away the guilt, it takes away the pain, it takes away the feeling, it takes away those visions. It allows me to function in this world, it allows me to sleep at night, it allows me to get up in the morning. If it would not have been for alcohol, if alcohol did not work the way it works with me, I would not be your speaker tonight. I would have joined your brother. But alcohol worked for me. You know, I heard my friend Moselle last night talking about bottoms, but that's a myth. I'm here to tell you. You can pick one if you want. You know, you don't have to go any farther than you've gone. I work in a place much like the place Moselle works, you know, and I see bottom all the time. I have someone die about every 2 weeks. I've seen my ex-mother-in-law committed to an institution for Kerckhoff syndrome, which is wet brain. She spent the last 10 years of her life wanting a cigarette, even while she was smoking five of them. And she never got any worse. But you know, it's been my experience with the disease of alcoholism. As long as you can think and feel and have one thing going on between your ears, that it never, ever, ever stops getting worse. You know, the stuff starts going away pretty quick. And the stuff in my life started going pretty quick. About that time, my wife decided to make a career move, and she moved in with my coke connection. And I don't blame her, you know. He had a hell of a lot more going on than I did. I was just in pain. And the only thing left was just me and my little girl, Jana Marie. And Jana was 7 years old, and Jana, up to this time, had an ideal life, man, and she had everything. We had a beautiful place. It was on a stream. Everything was fixed up for children. Her bedroom was like a, you know, Cinderella. It was just one beautiful place. And she was with her daddy and with her brother and with her uncle and her mother, and everything was wonderful. And then all of a sudden, within like a 9-month period, like a bomb came into that home. And her mother was gone, and her brother was destroyed, and her uncle was dead. And her father, who she adored, was absolutely insane. And it was just me and her. And this guy came over to my house one night, and he brought this stuff called Mad Dog 2020. They have that here? I thought you guys just drank beer in Wisconsin. Man, oh man. I drank that bottle. And this lady said, the next thing I knew, she said, "Sir, you're going to have to get off the airplane." And I opened my eyes and I looked around, and my little girl was all cuddled up next to me, you know. And then I'm on this big jet, and it's completely empty except for us. And I said, where am I? And she said, "You're in Florida, Fort Lauderdale." And I said, "I don't like Fort Lauderdale." You know? She goes, "I don't know nothing about it, man. You got to get off the plane." I'm very confused, but I'm still trying to retain my dignity in front of my daughter, you know, and I'm trying to pump her very, very cautiously about what we're doing in Florida. She has no idea. So I did what any one of you would have done. I called a cab. I said, "You know, take me to a hotel and stop at a liquor store because I need to figure out what's happened here." And I came to, in full restraints, in this gray room with bars, and I was completely tied down and butt naked. And I found out, I didn't know where my daughter was, I didn't know where I was, and I asked, they let me go, and I found out that I met this couple at this hotel, and we had started drinking, and I went completely insane. Started breaking stuff up and just going nuts, and they just put me in the nut house. And when I got out of there, thank God these people had taken my daughter and they were taking care of her. And I just told my daughter, I said, "You know, I told you this place was rotten. We got to get out of here." You know, and we left. And I could tell you if talk for the rest of the night on the next couple of years, you know, because it never got any different than that. I lived in 5 different states over the next 2 years. And there's 1,000 stories just like those two. And everywhere I went, I promised my daughter it's going to be different. I promise you we're going to get a home. I promise you you're going to be able to go to school. I promise you that, you know, I'm going to be there for you. And I meant it. I really meant it. I came to live in Oklahoma City, and I come walking in, and I was staggering. And I had blood on my clothes, and it wasn't mine. My daughter knew by then, and she just looked at me. And she just sighed, and she picked up her pillow, and she picked up her doll, and I changed clothes, and we left. And we got on this bus. And I got a bottle, and I drank it, and I passed out on the bus, and we came to in New Mexico, and And my little girl, when I come to, she was rocking and she was crying. And I said, "What's the matter, baby?" And she says, "Daddy, I am so hungry. You haven't fed me." And I said, "As soon as we stop, I'll feed you." We pulled in this little place, and I went in this liquor store, and I was so sick. I needed a drink so bad. And I walked in, and I got me a bottle of wine, and I went up and got her a sandwich, and I got up to pay for it, and I only had enough money for one or the other. I had to put her sandwich back. I've done a lot of things in my life that I don't share from the podium. I'm very, very selective people. But I've never done anything in my life that haunted me more than that moment right there. When I looked in my little girl's eyes, and she smelled that cheap wine on my breath. And it was just a look that I can't even describe to you. And we got back to California, and I went to go see my mom. I hadn't seen her in years. And my mom is, my mom's tough. The neighbor back-talked her one time. She knocked him out with a shovel, you know. My mom says something, "You move," you know. And she grabbed my daughter. And she said, "You, get off my property." And I grabbed my daughter and I said, "Where will we go?" And she grabbed my daughter and said, "I don't know, but if you don't get off my property, I'm going to call the police and we ain't going nowhere. You are." Thank God for my mom, man. She wouldn't give me an inch. Anyone would have given me an inch, I'd have used them up. The next 3 years, I was a wino. Basically, you know, I lived on the streets. I lived in the bushes in a place called Carlsbad, California. It's a very ritzy little town. They've got a nice bamboo patch across from this 7-Eleven right on the beach where the septic tank drained down from this restaurant, and nobody went down in it, and that was my condo. And I panhandled for wine in front of the 7-Eleven, and I went down to my bamboo patch, and I drank until I ran out, and I went back, and I got some more, and I did that until I was either arrested or until I was hit by a car or beat up by someone or went absolutely berserk, and they locked me up. And alcohol worked. I was real sick. As you're meeting, they talk about fear in meetings. I want to tell you my version of fear. Fear is you're physically addicted to alcohol. You no longer have any choice whatsoever. You have to drink at certain times of the day or you're liable to go into a grand mal seizure. And you don't have a home. And it's 5:45 in the morning on a Sunday morning. And you're starting to see the aura. You're starting to feel the shakes. You know what's coming. You know what's going to happen any minute. A short dog of port wine cost 87 cents. You got 65 cents. You got 15 minutes. And nobody's giving you another penny. That's fear. Because see what happens. If you go into a seizure, they call the ambulance. And the ambulance come and they detox you. People just wouldn't let me get done. They just kept intervening on my drinking, you know. And it takes a while to get that going, you know. A lot of work. And I'd have to start all over, and I was scared, man. I was scared. And this, it turned 6 o'clock. I saw him open those coolers. I looked at my money, and I'm thinking, man, a beer won't do it. I got to have that much wine in me. And I'm thinking, and this little four-door sedan pulls up, and there's a square guy standing there in a three-piece suit, and he's got these square little kids and the square wife sitting next to him. And I'm shaking my head, wondering how they can live that way, you know. And he gets out of that car, and he comes up to me, and he looks at me, and he says, "Kip, how are you?" And I looked at him, and it was a guy that I'd known when I was a kid, and he was one of those people I hated. He came from a nice family. He came from, you know, he lived in the white section of town, you know, and he always had nice clothes, and everyone liked him, and I just hated people like that. And he looked at me, and he just smiled, and he gave me $2. I'll never forget that, man. I got $2. At that period, it's like, you do believe in Santa Claus, you know? And it was just incredible sigh of relief. And I ran in that store and I got a whole quart of wine. And I had a little bit of change left to start the next run. And I'm shuffling off and I looked in the glass as I walked by and I saw that family sitting in that car looking at me. And I knew they were judging me. I knew they were standing and judging me. And I cursed them. And I went down in my little condo. And I opened up that bottle and I said, "La puerta," the doorway. I don't care what's going to happen, but if it'll stop the screaming, let's go. And I had the damnedest thought I've ever had. Came out of nowhere like a bolt of lightning. Said, maybe you ought to go to A&A. That family became really good friends of mine over the years past, since then. And I'll tell you, that family wasn't judging me. That was a very good Christian family. And I'm not here to talk about religion. I don't have any basis in Alcoholics Anonymous. But instead of what I thought they were doing judging me, when I walked off, that family got out of their car that morning and they got on their knees in that parking lot and they prayed for that poor, pitiful man. And while they were praying for that poor, pitiful man, I had this sudden thought of maybe I ought to go to this A&A. And I don't know how, but I got to a meeting that night. And most of what I'm going to tell you from here on in, a big part of it's hearsay. I walked in this room and I looked in. And see, I'd been to those H&I meetings before in different institutions, and they had told me all about y'all's program and that you would welcome newcomers, and I very graciously explained to them that I was not an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. I just can't afford alcohol. I mean, I can't afford drugs right now, you know. And they looked at me and they smiled and they said, well, someday when you have a problem with alcohol and you can't stop drinking, if you'd ever like to come to our fellowship, you know, we'd be more than glad to have you. And they said, we'll welcome you with open arms. So I'm thinking, you know, okay. And I walked in this room and they looked a lot like you people. They were all clean cut. And I'll explain a little bit here. I'd been living in the same clothes for 3 years. And my hair came down past my waist and my beard came down past my belt. And a lot of things lived on me besides me. And I was a science experiment, you know. And I come walking in and I was waiting for the welcome. And I sat down next to this pretty little gal, man. And she just about slid all the way down. And people are just kind of looking at me and they're very, you know, and I'm waiting for the welcome. And man, I'm looking around, man, I'm getting uncomfortable. And you guys are talking about God. I saw you pass this basket. I said, they're going to start singing any minute. And I'm uncomfortable, and I know, man, I knew I was right. This is not for people like me. I asked them if they had a room for the more severe cases, you know, but they said this was it. And I'm ready to leave, but there had been this one old gal, and she kept staring at me from the minute I walked in the room, and she kept smiling. She was the only one out of that group, and she just kept smiling at me. And I just figured she was one of them wet brain women I'd heard about, you know, and I figured she must be awful bad because I couldn't even imagine she wanted anything I had, you know. And I got ready to leave, and she shot to her feet, and this is what she told me. I've never met that woman since. She stood up, and she looked me right in the eye in front of all those people, and she said, I walked in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous 27 years ago in Long Beach, California. She said, I walked into a meeting a lot like this, and I came in the back, and I looked around. And I looked at all you ladies. And you were ladies. And I looked at all you men. And I knew that the women would turn me away because when they saw what I was. She goes, I've been a prostitute on the streets of Long Beach and I've done everything a woman ever had to do to survive. And I knew that you would turn your back on me if I told you who I was. And she goes, and I turned around to leave and a woman came and grabbed me. And she took me to a seat and got me a cup of coffee. And she told me this. She said, please, honey, don't go nowhere. We need you desperately. She proceeded to talk about her home group, about the women who helped her get sober, who taught her how to be a woman, how taught her how to be a lady. She talked about her sponsor. She talked about the 12 steps. She talked about the service in Alcoholics Anonymous. She talked about the wonderful things that had happened in her life and some horrible tragedies, and she had never had to run. She had never had to drink, and she had been able to walk through dignity of 27 years of sobriety. She walked on in front of all those people, and she held me in her arms very, very close and tight, and she kissed me right on the mouth, the bravest woman I have ever met in my life. I mean, only a hardcore hooker from Long Beach could have handled that. You know? She held me close. And she told me this, and she said, "Honey," she says, "darling, don't go nowhere. We need you desperately." I have never shed a tear in my life. You can't make me cry. I started putting on armor when I was a little kid. I don't let nothing happen. I don't let nothing affect me. And something happened. Well, that was, she wouldn't let go of me. She just held me. And all of a sudden, this thing started happening right inside of my gut. And I didn't know what it was. And it was this sob and this cry. And I started shaking and I started crying. And tears started rolling down my eyes. And I'd never done that. And I wanted what that woman had more than anything in this world. So I started coming to this A&A. And y'all lied to me, every one of you, right from the beginning. You told me that if I would quit drinking alcohol, my life would get better. I'm here to tell you right now that alcohol is not my problem. It never has been my problem, and it never will be my problem. It has caused some problems in my life, I'll grant you. But alcohol is not my problem. It is my solution for living in this world. And when I see, my problem is not alcohol. My problem is I have an acute allergic reaction to sobriety. You know? At about 3 days of abstinence, I go absolutely stark raving sober. You know? And I cannot imagine in any wildest nightmare why you would ever want to feel like this. Everything's so real, you know? You also pointed out those steps, and I looked at those steps. I saw that God thing, you know. I said, "I'm powerless. I've been carrying a gun all my life. I had never been powerless, you know." And saw that God stuff. Man, I don't need that. Just drove right by that. And I got up to that. I said, "What the hell is that?" And he said, "Well, that's a fourth step." And I said, "Well, tell me about it. What's that? What do you do?" And he told me what you did, and I almost fell out of my chair laughing. You see, I learned when I was a little kid, you don't cop to nothing, even if they got pictures, you know? Make them prove it, you know? Demand a jury trial and hope for the best, you know? Only thing you ever tell people is what they want to hear. You know, so that you can get what you want from them. You don't ever share a weakness with another man. They'll use it on you. The world I come from, you don't share weakness. You don't let anyone see it. They'll eat you alive. I'd listen to you people share, I'd be absolutely so embarrassed for you. I'd have to leave the room sometimes. I looked at that eighth and ninth step a little bit. I said, "What's that all about?" And he said, "Well, you got to go back and you got to fix everything you've ever broken." I thought about that one for a minute. And anything I ever took for you, if you're stupid enough to let me have it, that's on you. You know? I ain't giving nothing back. And some of those amends are absolutely impossible for me to do. They told me to get a sponsor. I've been on parole half my life. I'm not about to volunteer one of you lops to tell me what to do, you know? So I started going. I just went to meetings. I just go to meetings, and I went to meetings, and I went to meetings, and I went to meetings, and I don't know if there's anyone here tonight that's just going to meetings. But if you're just going to meetings, and you're not taking these steps, and if you're not actively involved in a home group, and if you're not actively involved in action in this program, you're just wasting your time. And I would highly suggest you pay your medical insurance up, because this is a killer disease and it just waits. And you can stay sober on other people's sobriety for a little while, but pretty soon it'll be midnight and it'll just be you. And you'll get to find out if there's any conditions, and you'll drink. Dr. Silkworth told us a long time ago. He said, "Unless we experience that psychic change, we're doomed to do this over and over. Change the way I think. How the hell do I change the way I think? I've been thinking this way all my life." And I went to meetings, and I was, for the next 6 years, I went to meetings on a regular basis. And part of my life, little pieces of it, got a little better. I'd hear little things and, you know, and it was a very, very slow process of even learning how to listen and learning even what you people were talking about. See, I come from a world, when I walked in these rooms at the age of 36 years old, I didn't even have an identification. I'd never had an identification in my name. I have never held a job. I've never been a part of this world. I'm an outlaw, man. I live in Mexico, and I do whatever I want to do whenever I want to do it. And if you catch me, I change my ID, and I move to the next place. And you're telling me all this stuff I got to do, get jobs, do this, you know, blah, 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 man. And I would stop drinking, you know, and all of a sudden that guilt and all those feelings would come up again, and I'd have to drink. And I did that for 6 years. And the disease progressed, and it progressed, and it progressed. In the big book, In the Vision for You, it talks this. It says, you know, there'll come a time where you'll not be able to imagine life with alcohol or without it. And you'll know loneliness that just few people can imagine. I know exactly what that means to the very core of my existence. Because, see, I came to a Christmas morning, one more time, strapped down, butt naked in a rubber room, covered with blood. This time it was mine. Christmas morning. And you know when you wake up that way on Christmas morning, you just lose all faith in Santa Claus, you know. And they let me out of there. They knew me so well at that drunk tank. They just let me go, and they said, we'll see you later. And it was Christmas morning, and I just wandered off, and I went back to my little place. And I'd been sober at that time for almost 35 days. And I had a little job, and I rat-holed as much money as I could, and I had about $85, and I went right down to the liquor store, and I got as much wine as I could possibly carry, and I went up there, and I started drinking. And I continued to drink, and then it happened to me on January 6, 1984. It was the absolute most tragic day of my life. I remember that day crystal clear, because that was the day that alcohol didn't work no more. And when alcohol does for you what it does for me, and you've been to Alcoholics Anonymous for years, and Alcoholics Anonymous does not work for you. When alcohol stopped working and it didn't take the pain away no more, when it didn't take away those visions, when I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober, the thought of living, I knew loneliness. If loneliness would have been a tangible thing, would have absolutely eaten me alive. And when I realized it wasn't going to work no more, I pulled out my gun and I put it to my heart and I pulled the trigger. And I blew my left lung and two ribs out and knocked me all the way across the room. And I slid down that wall with blood flying everywhere. And the only thought I had in my mind was, thank God this nightmare's over with. Thank God I'm not going to have to see that look of humiliation anymore in the mirror. Thank God I'm not going to hurt anyone that cares for me anymore. And I come to in this hospital. You guys thought I died, didn't you? Now, there was this old-timer, a guy named Charlie Tuck. I'll break his anonymity. He's gone to the big meeting. He'd been sober so long in AA, they only had one A in it when he got here. You know? And I hated this man. I hated him. He was born in the same blue suit. I mean, you never saw him. He always had the same blue suit, no matter everywhere you saw him. You know, and he came up to me at a meeting of alcoholics in those years I was struggling. He got dead in my face. He was from Chicago. And he looked me right in the eye and he said, you think you're pretty tough, don't you, kid? I looked him right back in the eye. I gave him my best jailhouse look. I said, I'm tough enough, old man. Don't you ever doubt that. He looked at me and he got this big grin on his face. He says, you ain't tough. He says, you're the scaredest son of a bitch in this room. He said, that might make you dangerous, but it don't make you tough. And he walked away laughing at me, you know. From that point on, every time I'd go to a meeting of an Alcoholics Anonymous, I waited and made sure he wasn't there. When I got sober and I did my inventory and I got to my fears and I realized the fear that it absolutely ran every aspect of my life. And that fear was of you men. I was terrified of you guys. I'll do anything in this world to prove to you I'm not afraid of you. I'll shoot you. I'll knife fight. I'll do whatever we got to do. But I would rather have you kill me than to see the fear. I would absolutely rather you kill me than to see that fear, to take off that armor. And that man saw right through me. I opened my eyes in this hospital, and Charlie had this real deep, gravelly voice, very unique, you know. And I just coming out of this coma, and I hear this voice. And I crack one eye because I ain't going to give it up, you know. And there's Charlie Tuck in that blue suit with that big, ugly blue book. And these two newcomers standing at the foot of my bed, and their eyes are about this big looking at me. And I go, oh, my God, I've died. I've gone to hell, and they got AA here. And Charlie Tuck's running it, you know. I'm laying there, man. I ain't going to give it up. I know he's going to start preaching that A&A stuff at me. And Charlie don't say one word to me. What he does, he puts his arm around these two young men. And he said, you see this pitiful man laying here? And they went, yeah. And they went, he goes, pay attention. This is what happens to an alcoholic who doesn't take the steps. Come on, let's go. Now, he obviously didn't know how sensitive I am. I'd like to let you know that those two men are still sober today. I was doing active 12-step work long before I got sober. I after about 75 days, I got out of that hospital, And on May 12th, it was no different than any other day. I come to in the morning. Alcohol doesn't work no more. And the first thought I have is, I'm still alive. Shit. And I got to get something in my body before the screaming starts. Knowing that it probably isn't going to work, but it's the only hope I got. And something happened that morning. You see, I've been to so many of these A&A meetings that you guys had poisoned my mind. And the only thing I could think of that morning was the ABCs. It's right at the end of chapter 5. It says that I'm powerless over alcohol. Now, I know I'm an alcoholic. I have absolutely no... I have documentation from the state of California. You know, I got paperwork, man. I said, I'm powerless in my life, son, man. I said, what does that mean, man? I've said it 1,000 times, but what does it mean? It says in that book, it says, it don't matter what I admit to you or to anyone else. That in my innermost self, inside, deep down, where I live, where none of you can see, that I have to understand exactly what that means. And I suddenly had that vision. It was just like a channel, a TV came on, and I saw, it was like I was watching it from above. I saw that poor, pitiful man get on that bus and tell the little girl that he would have given his life for, that he couldn't feed her because he had to drink. And it suddenly dawned on me, and I understood exactly what alcohol, how alcohol affects me. And this is the way it is. When I put alcohol in my body from that moment on, it doesn't matter about who I love. It doesn't matter about my dreams, my plans, my morals. It sure as hell doesn't matter about yours. I have to do whatever alcohol tells me to do. And alcohol tells me where I can live, and it tells me when I get up, and it tells me when I go to bed. It tells me who I can hang with. It tells me who I can't. And there ain't no room for nothing else but alcohol. It said, my life's unmanageable. I love chaos to this very day. But I started thinking what that means, you know, and my interpretation of it came like this. I can remember when I was that little kid laying in that bed waiting for my father to come home, and me and my little brother, we were talking about the kind of men we were going to be and the kind of fathers we were going to be and the kind of husbands we were going to be, and I got a real crystal clear look at the man that I had turned into. And it was a far cry from that little boy's dream. And I realized that the way I run my life is absolutely a mess. And then I got to that next verse that says that no human power was going to fix me. I kept hoping one of you gals were going to fix me. A few of you tried. If you're here tonight, I'd like to make amends. You know? I kept hoping someone was going to say something magic to me. Someone was going to do something. And they were going to heal me. Says in there, says that absolutely no human power.
And then I got to that stuff, man, I didn't want nothing to do with. You see, because this deal with God, I got nothing coming from God. I was raised by, like, my grandmother was a Pentecostal evangelist. And I grew up in those tent revivals, and they told me that every time I thought of a sin, I was as good as guilty. And by the time I was about 11 years old, it was too late. I hadn't done anything yet, but I thought about all of it, and I was guilty, you know. And I knew, I just gave that stuff up, man. I don't want nothing to do with this God. And God likes those people in the suburbs. He don't like people like me. I pissed him off since I've been here. He's got nothing coming from me, I got nothing come from him, and that's okay. But I started thinking about the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and not only Alcoholics Anonymous, but in other places. People who had what I wanted. And it wasn't their money, and it wasn't their women, and it wasn't their stuff, it was a look in their eye. And the way they walked through life with dignity, with no matter what happened. And they talked about this power that did for them that they couldn't do for themselves. And I got down on my knees that morning and I cried out to this God that I don't know nothing about. And this was the prayer I cried out. It hasn't changed too much since then. I said, you know, I don't know who you are and I don't know what you are. And I hope that don't make no difference. But from this point on, I will do whatever you put in front of me if I don't have to drink alcohol. And if you're not there, I'm screwed. And the longer I've been sober, I know what a state of grace was given me that morning. Because with that statement, I suddenly realized in my heart of hearts that if I could keep that simple concept, I wasn't going to have to drink that day. And I went over to go see that old man, Charlie Tuck. And his gracious, gracious Al-Anon wife. And I walked on that door, and Edie opened the door, and she looked at me like she'd been waiting for me. She said, oh, Kip, it's so good to see you. Charlie's going to be so excited. She goes, sit down, and she had detoxed so many, man. She got me a big glass of orange juice, it was half orange juice and half honey. And I sat there, and I started drinking that and started shaking. And here comes Charlie out of his study in that same blue suit. And he walked in, and he just looked at me, and he just smiled from ear to ear. And he looked at me and he said, what can I do for you, Kip? Good to see you. I said, Charlie, I don't want to drink no more. He says, yeah? He says, what are you willing to do? I said, whatever you tell me. He said, are you done? I said, Charlie, I pray to God that I'm done. He goes, that's the right answer, son. He goes, let's go in my study. And we sit down. And Charlie told me his story. And Charlie had been in a gangster in Chicago in the 20s. And I asked Charlie, I said, how did you know that about me when you came up and told me I was a skinhead? He says, because you were just like me. And I could see it. Just like me. He says, Kip, he says, I don't know why. I don't know why God has opened this window for you, because I'm going to tell you quite frankly, people like you don't get sober. I've been watching you for a long time, and there's something badly damaged in you, and people like you don't get sober. Very few, even in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know why God has opened this window for you, but I would suggest you step in all the way. And he said, I'm going to tell you the way it's going to have to be for you, one day at a time, the rest of your life. And that is this, that absolutely nothing, that absolutely nobody, that no job, no woman, no child, nothing in this world could ever be more important than you doing the things that you have to do to maintain your sobriety. And the day that you think anything in this world is more important than you doing the things that you have to do, that's the day you're getting ready to take a drink and you will never get to get sober again. And you won't die. You'll spend many, 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 many years in that gray, gray, twilight, nowhere place. And I knew he was right. He said, come on, and it was on Mother's Day. And he took me out to this park that was right in front of his house and he said, get on your knees. And he got on his, and I'm standing there, and he said, I said, get on your knees. I said, Charlie, there's people all around here. He said, Kip, you've been the town drunk here for 3 years. These people have been stepping over you for the last 3 years. You're halfway to your feet on your knees. And he held my hand, and he taught me that third step prayer that Mazel told us about last night. And he taught me how to pray. And then he stood up and he said, this is a program of action. This is a book. Read it. And I started reading it. And I said, what else? He says, get a job. I'm going, no, no, I need to work on my recovery. He said, no, no, you get a job. sober people work. And I said, well, I don't really know how to do anything. He says, well, do you know how to pray? I said, yeah. He goes, turn that over to God along with everything else, and a job will open up. And, you know, and I went and talked to my mom. I did that, and I went and talked to my mother. And I'm really confused about this God stuff, man. Really, really confused. I know there's something, but I can't put my finger on it, you know. And I'm just hoping against everything that he's really there. And my mom ran sport fishing boats. She owned boats. And I begged her to give me a job. It's the only thing I really know how to do. And she said, Kip, you know, there's liquor out there all day. Can you? I said, Mom, I got to work. And I think I can do it. And she said, I'll try it out. And she gave me a job. And I'm getting ready. I'm standing in the morning. I told Charlie what I was going to do. And he said, I told him I'm going to be the only sober person out there. And he goes, that's okay. You can go anywhere. If you're spiritually fit. He says, you better find a God and you better grab on hold. And I was down there and I was watching them load these kegs of beer on the boat, you know, and I'm going, uh-oh, you know. And about that time, I'm saying, God, if you're there, you better intervene. And about that time, this pelican flew over me, and he looked down at me just about like an old-timer does at these meetings. You know, he goes, worked. I knew something was watching me. I don't know. I was sick, you know. My idea of God has evolved a great deal since that day, I want to tell you. But I knew, I felt in my heart something was watching me, and I worked on that boat, and I was the only sober person on it all single day for the next year. And every time I thought about drinking, there'd be a pelican watching me. You know? You know, I told this story after some tragedies you'll hear about, and I went to find some meeting where I could find some anonymity, and I'm sitting in the back, and this guy came up to me in this meeting, and he goes, you're Kip, aren't you? And I'm going, yeah. And he said, oh, man, I've been looking for you for years. He said, about 5 years ago, you spoke at the Crown Valley Parkway meeting, and you talked about that pelican. I didn't want to go to that meeting anyway, but they told me this guy was there, so I went, and you told me that story about that pelican, and I thought you were nuts, you know? And I live on a boat. I'm a professional photographer. The next morning, I poured myself a big glass of gin, and I got up there, and I was sitting there about thinking, well, if I take this drink, I'll drink the rest of the day. And he said, I looked up, and there was a pelican hovering over me. He said, I took this picture, and I want to tell you, I haven't had a drink since that day. And I took this picture, and I had it framed, and I've been carrying it for you ever since. And it was in the trunk of his car, and he gave it to me, and it's over my bed, you know. You never know what you're going to say, you know. You never know what's going to happen. And I'll tell you this, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, he got me involved. I didn't go to meetings. I got involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to get to a meeting every single night. I had to get there a half hour early to help out in any way I possibly could. I had to stand at that door and shake hands with every single person that walked in that room. And I had to beg for a commitment. And if they wouldn't give me one, I had to help someone else do theirs. But I had to be there. And I had to go to coffee with these guys after the meeting. And I had to do this every day. And I'm coming up on 90 days, and Charlie says, I told Charlie, I said, hey, I almost got 90 days. He goes, so what? I said, well, you know, 90 and 90. And he goes, that doesn't apply to you. Me and you talked. You said you're not like these people. He says, I'm afraid you're right. He says, you just keep going till I tell you to stop, you know. And this is what I had to do. I had to carry a commitment 5 nights a week at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to have a commitment at a book study, at a step study, at a men's meeting, at a speaker's meeting, and at a participation meeting. And he taught me what the word commitment means in Alcoholics Anonymous, which since I've been here, which hasn't been too long, I've seen a lot of people start really diluting this word, you know. And the word is commitment. And as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, if I tell you I'm going to do something, the only excuse for me not doing it is I died on the way there. You know, and that's the way my sponsor raised me in this outfit, you know. And he called me one night, a Friday night. I was home. Someone ratted me out. They'll do that to you around here, you know. He says, you got the coffee commitment at St. Michael's. What are you doing home? I said, Charlie, I'm sick. I feel like I'm dying. I got Bob to do it. He goes, it's not Bob's commitment. It's yours. You can die on the way there, you can die while you're making it, or you can die on the way home. You get your ass down to that meeting. You know? And thank God, that's the way Charlie was to me. And I don't want to get to tell you that he was mean to me. He was not cruel to me. He was stern, and he was firm, and he did not give me 1 inch to hang myself. And he kept me busy. And he took me through those steps that first year, and he got me actively involved in the Hospital Institutional Committee. And things in my life started changing, you know. Things started happening. And then I met her. Wonderful gal. She got sober the same day I did. She drank like I did. She did all the same things I did. And it was definitely God's will, Mazel. Definitely. And I, you know, I told her and went, and we just had this incredible AA romance, and I fell mad over head over heels in love, which I didn't know yet, that I didn't know anything about. And I told her I wanted to marry her, but she would never be more important than AA. And she said, "Yeah, well, same to you, you know. And you'll never be more important than AA to me either." And what happened in that marriage that was based on Alcoholics Anonymous? And she had her meetings, and I had my meetings, and we became involved, and we had one of the best marriages I've ever known of anybody having in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she was my dearest friend. She was my lover. She was everything. She was the very first woman that I had ever let inside, that I took off all the armor and let her see who I was, that I was truly intimate with. You know, at 3 years sober, I got this phone call. It was an amazing day. That day that the state of California had given me my driver's license back, and that's something that's absolutely impossible for me, to have a driver's license in the state of California, and that's a whole pitch in itself. But I got my driver's license back, and I'd become a contractor, and I had just signed a contract on a six-figure project. And I got this phone call, and this little girl said, "Is your name Kip Collins?" And I said, "Yeah." She goes, "Do you know Sandy so-and-so?" And I said, "Wow, a long time ago." She goes, "That's my mother, and you're my father. And I want to meet you. And I want you to meet your grandchildren." And I had a beautiful life, and I had a home. And I want to tell you, with all that, I still had a lot of old ideas in Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I spent a lot of my life in institutions and prisons. And there's a lot of prejudice, there's a lot of stuff that happens in prisons, man, that there's a color line, and you draw that line, and it's sharp and clear, and there ain't nothing, no speculating on it. And there were things that, you know, that I had no problem with, but I was just never going there, man. You know, that's there, I'm here, pop. And my sponsor told me, "Someday you're going to have to deal with that." And that little girl came into my life, and she brought over my grandchildren, and all three of my grandchildren are black, you know. And I looked at those babies, and I could hear God laughing at me. And I started laughing right along with him, you know. And that ugly, ugly part of me was healed right then and there, you know. And I just laughed, and I held those babies, you know, and it was just one of the greatest growth of my whole sobriety, you know, and I became real close to her, you know, and I got that little boy back, and I got my daughter back, and I adopted these other three girls, and my life was full. And at 10 years sobriety, let me tell you, I had it all, man. I had the house on the hill, I had the boat, I was making well over $150,000 every single year. I was a member of a church, you know. Since my family was Pentecostal, I joined the Catholic Church, and give them an opportunity to grow. And I became very involved in my faith. And I was teaching baptism at my parish. And me and my wife both were. And we were both involved in our church. And I was involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had an incredible career. And my kids were wonderful. Everything was wonderful. I did this job, made all this money. And I went to Australia. And I spent 2 months in Australia just going to AA meetings every single night in a different town, from Sydney to northern Queensland. And it was a dream I'd always wanted to do. And I came back to California. And I came back, me and my wife, and we were sitting there, and I was counting my blessings. I was looking at my home and everything in my life. How did I get from that bamboo patch to here? How did that happen? And I opened up the newspaper, and I started reading. And on the front page, there was a story about this man who broke into this girl's home and raped her in front of her children and took a knife and cut her to pieces. And I got down to the girl's name, and it was my daughter. And I'll tell you this, that I identified with Moselle again. If you touch something I love, I'm perfectly capable of putting a bullet in your head. And what happened was the insanity returned. You see, I don't know about anger. I don't even waste my time on anger. I know about making plans for you. You know, I know about ice water pumping in my veins. I know about getting real, real quiet, not talking to nobody about what I'm about ready to do. And I went absolutely insane. And my sponsor told me, he said this, he said all the answers are in that book. And I grabbed hold of that book and I started reading. I started looking for a loophole is what I was looking for. And I started reading it, and the only thing it says is this. It'll save y'all a lot of work. It says that anger, it says resentments are number one killer of Alcoholics Anonymous. It said it'll cut me off from the sunlight of the Spirit, and the insanity will return, and you will drink again. And it doesn't say unless someone rapes your daughter. It says that it will kill me, that I will drink again. And I remember what my sponsor told me, that absolutely nothing, no child, no woman, nothing in this world can be more important than me doing the things that I have to do to stay sober. So I have to read a little bit farther in that book. It tells me if I got a resentment against someone that I can't get rid of, that I got to get on my knees and pray for that individual to have everything out of life that I want. And it was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And I got on my knees every single day and I prayed for that man. And I'm not going to tell you that I absolutely, totally forgive that man, but I'll tell you this, that the insanity went away. That's something that I'm still working on as far as... But the insanity went away. That ice water went away in my veins. And I was able to go talk to the men in my life and share what was going on with me. And when I started talking about it, it was like lance in a boil. I let the poison out. And I was able to go be a father to that little girl for the first time when she needed me more than any time in her whole life that she had ever needed me. And I had the financial resources to help her. And I was there for my grandchildren. And I helped them. And I became a member of my family. And a great healing happened, and I found out I didn't have to drink. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous worked. And I got through that. You know, right after that, they had told me that I had cancer and that I'm going to have to remove my lower lip. I like my lip. I like right where it's at, you know. And I told my sponsor, and he said, you know, go see another doctor. And I went and saw five different doctors, and I went and finally went and talked to this one plastic surgeon who was in the program. And I started telling him, and he told me, well, we can do this surgery. He said it's going to be incredibly painful. And I explained to him what I was going through right at that time, that I still had a lot of emotional pain, and you can't put anything in my body at this period of my life. Because if you put anything that blocks that pain, I don't know if I'll ever be able to stop again. And he agreed to do this surgery on Novocaine and aspirin and all. And they cut my lip from here to here to here, cut a wedge out and put it back together. And I do not recommend that to anybody, you know. But again, absolutely nothing in this world is more important than me being sober. The one thing I know from my heart is that no matter what I got to do to stay sober, it's a hell of a lot easier to stay sober than to get sober. And I've been through lots of physical pain. Physical pain goes away. And I got through that. You know, something had been happening with my wife. I didn't know what was going on, but something had changed in my wife. We weren't as close as we had been. Something was there, and I couldn't put my finger on it. And I loved my wife. I would be excited about coming home from work because I knew she'd be there. It was just that after 10 years, I was excited about coming home. I loved her so intensely. And I said, come. She goes, Kip, I came here, and she was crying. And I said, what's the matter? And she goes, we have to talk. And I sat down, and I said, what's the matter, baby? And she took my hand. She says, Kip, she says, you know I love you. And I said, yeah, I know you love me. I said, what's wrong? She goes, Kip, she goes, I don't want to hurt you. She goes, but I can't live this lie anymore. And I said, what are you talking about? And she said, Kip, she goes, I'm a lesbian. And I'm in love with Christy, and I can't deny it no more, and I have to leave, and I don't want to hurt you, but I can't do this no more. I'll drink. I didn't think she was going to say that. You know? And I had these horrible feelings of betrayal. And of anger and rage and resentment. And I called her things. And I hurt her. not physically, but verbally. And I had to go talk to my godfather. He's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous in the church. He's also a Catholic priest. He's been sober 28 years. He's passed on. I'll break his hand. His name just happened to be Father Bill Wilson, you know, and probably just a coincidence. But you see, he's a Catholic priest, and I know this guy's on my side, you know. Wait till I tell him this. And I go have a meeting with Father Bill, and I'm telling him the sad woe of what this woman has done to me. He's just looking at me, shaking his head. I said, "So, Father, what do you think?" He says, "I think you owe her an amends." Well, what are you talking about, man? He said, no, you know who you are? You're that guy on page 61 in the big book. I go, "What do you mean?" You know, that guy that thought he could wrest satisfaction out of life if he only managed well. You know, that sometimes he was kind, some kind he was generous, some kind, you know, keep telling me all these wonderful things you did for her and her children. You know, now she has done this to you. Did you do those things because you loved her or because you expected her to act a certain way from you giving it to her? He goes, "Kip, I am your confessor, and you are no one in this world to stand in judgment of another human being's sexuality. And just because that woman is your marriage, that does not mean you own her. And love has nothing to do with that. Now, I want you to go make amends to her, and I want you to write me a 6-page deal on an inventory of your marriage and what you know about love." And I went and did that, you know. I didn't make that amends because I wasn't going to do that yet. But I did that inventory. And I wrote this inventory on that marriage. And I realized my wife had been an excellent wife. I had no reason to be resentful at her. She carried her vows out until she couldn't anymore. And when she couldn't hold her vows, she came and told me she couldn't do it no more. She was honest with me. And she had been a good wife to me right up to that day. She'd done everything she promised me she would do. She had always been there for me. I started writing about love, and the only thing I know about love is what you people have taught me. No one asked me about my sexuality when I came in here. No one asked me nothing. You asked me if I had a desire to stop drinking. And you told me that you would love me until I learned how to love myself. And you did. And I went back, and I went and talked to my wife and her lady, and I made amends, and I meant it. And I meant it. And I told her this. I said, "If you can be happier than here and with me, then this is where you should be. And what can I do to help you? Because I love you. I truly love you. And I only want the best for you. And this is what you need to stay sober and to be happy. This is exactly where you should be." And I meant it from the bottom of my soul. And my wife, we got a divorce. It was very amicable, except for the fact she took my fishing boat. But that's another deal. And she kept my last name, and she became my sister. And I didn't know you could do that. You see, when a woman does you wrong, you kick him to the curb, and you just go next, you know. And I had a lot invested. I had 10 years invested in this relationship, and I didn't have to allow that relationship to go away. It just changed. It evolved into something else. And today she's a very dear friend of mine. Both of them are. You know, when I thought anything could happen, you know, the only thing that was left was just me and my son. And then I was on this job, and I got attacked by this dog. And it almost tore my arm off. And it was the same thing. I was in emotional pain, and I told this doctor, "Man, you can't. They want to give me morphine." I said, "You can't." And I had to go through this surgery, and man, I had an infection in my arm, and it was absolutely atrocious. But you know what? I didn't have to drink. I didn't have to use, but I couldn't work either. And as a result, all this other stuff happened, and the stuff started going, and I ended up losing my house, and I lost my business, and everything started crumbling, and it was just me and my son. And my son, Davey was the most gentle. I learned more from that little boy about dignity than any human being I've ever known in my life. And he couldn't talk, and he had brain damage. But he was a child of God, and it was an honor to be his father. And I watched him graduate from high school at the age of 23 years old. And they told me that he would be a vegetable. And we were involved in the Special Olympics, and we were involved in the church, and he grew up in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous through those 10 years. And he was my best friend. He worked with me, and he was with me all the time. And we went bowling to a state championship for Special Olympics, and my son got sick there, and I had to take him to the doctor, and the doctor put him in the hospital. And that was in May, and I sat with my son, and he got a staph infection in his blood. And And I sat with my son. And he got sicker and sicker and sicker. And I came in one day in the morning. And the nurse told me that my son was very excited and he wanted to see me. And I walked in that room and he looked at me and his eyes were real bright. And he told me, "Dad, it's sign language." He says, you don't have to worry about me no more. And he was very excited. And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "God came and talked to me last night. He said he's going to take care of me from now on." And I said, "Oh, that's good." And we spent that last day together. And that night, he died in my arms. And I didn't know. I didn't know you could hurt that much. I didn't know it was humanly possible to hurt that much. But it was at this time that I understood the promises. And I understood. It tells me I'll understand the word serenity. And I'll tell you what serenity is to me. Serenity is ain't nothing to do with pocket full of money and a beautiful sunset with her. Serenity was watching the thing I loved more than life itself die in my arms and hurting like I never knew you could hurt, and in my heart of hearts knowing that this is God's business and it's not personal and God don't make mistakes. And when my son died, I washed him for the last time and I shaved him for the last time and I got down on the knees. And I thank the God of my understanding for all of you people. Because you see, you people, you gave me 10 years to be the kind of father I dreamed about being the day he was born. I was the kind of father I dreamed about. I built that boat with my son. Me and my son did all those things together. And when my son looked at me, he looked at me the way I had always dreamed he'd look at me. He looked at me with pride and respect. And we loved each other deeply. And you gave that to me. I threw it away. I never lost nothing as a result of alcohol. I threw everything away for alcohol. And that little girl, a man came up to me and asked me for her hand in marriage right after that. And with the last of my credit cards, I gave my daughter a wedding at one of the most expensive hotels in San Diego, Torrey Pines. Gorgeous place. And she looked exactly the way I knew she would look the day she was born. And she looked at me when we walked down that aisle with the pride that I dreamed about the day she was born. And it cost me $250 a month, and it cost me that the rest of my life. And you gave that to me. You see, I threw that away, man. Nobody would give me credit. They wouldn't have financed me with a used toothbrush if I had 75% down when I got here. I am a success. I owe over $500,000 today, you know. And you gave me that, man. I threw that away. I threw that dream away. And you gave it to me. You know, and there was nothing left. It was just me. Everything was gone. Everything. 10 years sober. All that happened in a 6-month period. I didn't know what to do, you know, so I've only been to the 7th grade. I decide I'm going to go to school. And I go and talk to this career counselor. He tells me what do you want to do? And I told him what I wanted to do. He said, "That's going to take you 5 years. I said, "I'll give you 2. And he said, "You can't do it in 2. I said, "Sure, I can. Let me try." And they said, "Sure." And I started. And the last year of school, I took 24 units, a quarter, with no breaks. I'm not going to tell you I got real good grades, but I passed, you know. And I was getting ready to graduate, and the dean called me to the office, and she goes, "God, Kip, there was something I wanted to talk to you. What was it?" I said, "Well, it's obvious, Dean. Either you want to make me your assistant, or you're going to kick me out." She goes, "There's no gray areas in your life, is there?" She goes, "Oh, yeah. I need your high school diploma." I said, "Well, that's an easy. I didn't go." She goes, "Wait." I said, "I've only been to the 7th grade." She goes, "You can't do this without a college, without a high school diploma." I said, "I just did it." She goes, no, you got to have it. You got to go to high school. You got to get your diploma, you know, before you can graduate. And, you know, and that's in 2 weeks. And I said, okay. And, you know, and I went up to this place, and this GED test, and I said, look, I got to get a high school diploma. She goes, this isn't the DMV, you know. And she tells me what I got to do this. I said, no. Just give me the test. I'll take the test. I got to go. And she wasn't going to let me do it, and I pleaded and begged, and I told her what was going on, and she said, okay, and she let me take the test, and I got a 95% on it, and I graduated, and I went to a pawn shop, and I bought this ring. That's my high school ring. You know, after my wife left, you know, I wanted to jam a woman into my life. You know, and I'm telling him, I said, you know, I'm so lonely. He goes, you're not lonely, you're horny. You know, there's a big difference. And I said, no, I need a relationship, you know. And he goes, no, Kip, listen to me carefully. He says, an alcoholic can never have a relationship if they need one. It's impossible. You're just looking for someone to fix you. And no human power can fix you. You can't have a relationship until you learn how to be comfortable in your skin, till you don't need nobody. I said, can I date? And he goes, yeah, you can do that. You know. And he didn't let me get involved with anyone. I couldn't have any relationships, you know. And he said, you know, I want you to go places by yourself. And I started going places by myself. I started going camping by myself, you know, and I lived by myself. And after a while, you know, I'm sitting there with my dog, and my house is spotless. Everything I owned is iron. All my boots are polished. You know, my guns are clean. My house is clean. Everything in my house is in order. And I'm just sitting there watching TV, and I can watch anything in the world I want, you know. And I'm going, this is pretty nice. You know, this is pretty nice. This is what he was talking about. All right. So I immediately sabotaged it. You know, I said, God, thank you. This is wonderful. But if it be your will, I would love to experience true love one more time. But only if it's your will. You'll learn how to talk to God if you stick around, you know. Gotta be, it's all in the wording and in the wrist, you know. And I didn't think about it no more, you know, and I just went about my business, and I was supposed to speak this night in San Diego about 3 weeks later, and I came home from work early, and there was a message, and I pushed the button, and it was this girl that I had dated the year before, and it was her mother, and she wanted me to call her, and so I called her up. I said, what's going on? And she goes, oh, man, Carmen got drunk. Been drunk since you guys split up, you know, since she moved up to Los Angeles, and she got in a car wreck, and she's got brain damage, and she broke most of her bones in her legs. And I said, oh my God, well, what can I do to help you? She said, you can come up here and get your daughter. And I said, my daughter? What are you talking about? She goes, you don't know? And I said, know what? She goes, you have a 3-month-old daughter. So I got in my car, and I went to Los Angeles, and I walked in there, and they gave me this little 3-month-old baby. And I fell head over heels in love. Absolutely, totally in love. I put her right next to me in my little 240Z, and we hit it to San Diego from L.A., and I walked into the speaker meeting. I set her down next to the podium right here. I have no idea what I said that night, you know. And for the next year, I became a father again. And I became the kind of father I always wanted to be. You know, and I changed her diapers, and I went down to the doctor and got all of her shots, and I built a nursery in my room, you know, and my life was full with me and my daughter now. And I was at this meeting one night, and this lady that I've known for a long time, she goes, hey, can I hold your baby? Sure. And I'm knowing this girl, we got sober together. We've been on many committees together, and I'm looking at the way my daughter was looking at her. And I looked the way she's looking at my daughter, and I went, hmm. So after the meeting, I said, Sabrina, how you doing, girl? And she goes, good. I said, well, how's John? And she goes, oh, me and John have been divorced for 2 years. I said, oh, I'm so sorry. John's a good man. And I goes, yeah. I said, if you don't mind me asking, what happened? She goes, well, I wanted to have children. He didn't. And I go, you like children, do you? And me and Sabrina, I started dating her. And when I tell you I started dating her, I don't mean I started going to motels with her. I started dating her and getting to know her as a woman, as a human being, and a child of God, and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I fell in love. And we got married. And 22 months ago, we went to this hospital, and they put this little boy in my arms. And his name is Will Casey. I call him God's Will. And I fell head over heels in love. You know, today, I've got a beautiful home in Southern California. I have a job. I get to work with 135 men who are trying to put their lives back together. And I get to work with these newcomers all day long. And I have a job. It's 3 minutes from my house. I can hardly wait to get to work every day. And I can hardly wait to get home to my family. I have a group of men. When I talk about the tragedies that I've been through in this, I didn't do that alone. The men in Alcoholics Anonymous gathered me up and held me through every one of those incidents. I was never alone. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous will work for absolutely anybody, anywhere, under any circumstances. It doesn't matter what's going on in your life. It doesn't matter what you've done. Don't matter what you haven't done. If you're willing to live by these principles, these 12 steps, these 12 traditions, and a few other principles in that book, things are going to happen in your life that you're not going to be able to imagine. Some of you already know that. Some of you are going to find out. And I'd like to say this rather than the new people here tonight, but we talk a lot about willingness in AA, and I want to tell you my version of willingness, and then I'm going to sit down. Y'all know that story about Noah's Ark? Took two by two. When you become as willing as that third monkey, anything's possible. Now you think about that. You think that third monkey had any conditions whatsoever? I hope I never become Noah and I stay that third monkey. You know, I do whatever is asked of me in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm afraid to say no. I am God's favorite child. I am absolutely convinced of it. You know, I want to thank you all for letting me be here and be a part of this thing, this wonderful, wonderful thing that you people have. And thanks for letting me do this. And that's all I got for you.